And poof, it was gone. Went back to Harry Shearer's wiki page, and somebody had already gone in and taken out some of the things that had been hacked into it, and it wasn't me. I wish I could say I was that smart, but it wasn't me. But funny. I'm glad I got a screen capture of it so I can prove it. But if you were listening last hour, I hope you enjoyed that. Harry Shearer from Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind and other terrific movies and TV, of course, over the years. And a really good guy. And if you didn't catch it, go back and grab it on Streamlink. That'll be worth it. And this hour, of course, is going to be just, always good. Bart Ehrman was a typical evangelical Christian teenager who desired the study of the Bible in its original languages. And that's just when the trouble started. Jesus Interrupted, coming up next with Bart Ehrman on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Bart D. Ehrman, the author of Jesus Interrupted, was on with us when the hardcover version of the book came out, now out in softcover, revealing the hidden contradictions in the Bible and why we don't know about them. I want to start there. Good evening, Bart. How are you?
We're doing fine, thanks.
Always a pleasure. In fact, I just saw you today on the Discovery Channel. They were rerunning the Gospel of Judas documentary on the Discovery Channel.
Oh, yeah, right.
And you're in that.
Well, it's interesting stuff.
And I believe you said that, do I get your quote right? That you said that nobody understands Jesus like Judas. Does that sound right?
That sounds like something I may have said.
Yeah, I probably
Right.
hard. Yeah, and I like to think that that few talk show hosts understand Bart Ehrman as much as I do, and I like Judas maybe, but I do. I think, and I because and we've spoken before. My background, I have a master's of divinity, and there's something about the way in which you write, which is very familiar to me. It is the way we learn in seminary, but it's not the way that a lot of people learn about the text of the Bible and the gospel story and how one understands the historical criticism of the Bible text. And so, I mean, you obviously you're an anomaly in publishing in that you've taken something that's very specific and kind of scholastic, and you've universalized it, and you've built a strong, fan base out of that, right?
Yeah, so that is one of the ironies I try to deal with in the book, is that the sorts of things I talk about there are things that people who do divinity degrees at seminaries or divinity schools in the country, they hear this stuff and they learn it. It's part of their training, but then they don't communicate it with other people once they get out of seminary as a rule.
And the information, there's nothing. I mean, it's not that there's nothing new in it. There are new aspects of this, and you certainly nuance things in a fresh way for the reader. And yet, a lot of what you touch on, I think you're pretty open about. These are, in some cases, these are centuries old discoveries on the text that goes into the Bible.
That's exactly right. I mean, the reason I wrote the book is that this is information that's commonly known among scholars and has been for a long time. But the regular person in the street or the person in the pew has never heard it. And so that's why this kind of book was needed, to communicate with a broader audience what scholars have long said about the Bible.
That creates an interesting kind of dynamic for me, because there are people who, whether they are strongly, I'm trying to find I don't want to use the word fundamentalist, because fundamentalist can sound so pejorative and dismissive, and I don't mean that. But they are strongly, they have a core belief about the inerrancy of the Bible that they will be mad about tonight's show. And other times when we have guests on who talk about either the characters or some of the themes of the Bible and what we don't know about them, you'll have atheists who are a little antagonistic, who will send emails in saying, "Well, I bet you didn't know X, and I bet you've never heard Y," and they're almost word for word, quoting your book. And I want to, and to both of them, I mean, it's interesting that in both cases, people are reacting very strongly to the material in this book. And yet you didn't write this to arm atheists against people of faith, and you didn't write this to try to knock the faith legs underneath, you know, fundamentalists.
That's exactly right. It's interesting. My own email, I get a lot of email about the book, and the most antagonistic emails are almost always by people who haven't actually read the book.
Right.
Who've heard something about it and are upset, either because, you're right, it's one side or the other. It's either people who come from a very strongly evangelical Christian tradition, or people who are quite strongly atheist, and they have a knee-jerk reaction. But, you know, my response usually is they should just read the book and then see whether their judgments actually hold or not.
Well, Bart Ehrman, you know you're doing something right. When you, if after you publish a book like Jesus Interrupted, other people will actually write and then publish books like, you know, Bart Ehrman's Face Interrupted. You know, but they respond to your books. They write books trying to, you know, contradict the material in your books, which makes for a very lively dialogue, I think.
Yeah, it does. You know, my earlier book was called Misquoting Jesus, and there were actually three different books written to respond to misquoting Jesus. So, striking some kind of chord.
You didn't see the book Bart Ehrman's Face Interrupted? You didn't see that one?
No, you know, there have been a couple of books' response to Jesus Interrupted. I don't think I saw that one, though.
Okay, I may have been making that one up. I don't remember. but that goes back to the subtitle of the book, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. That a lot of people do know about them is a fact, and that a lot of people don't want other people to know about them still is also a fact. And they'll argue that this work is flawed because you start with the premise that God wrote the Bible, and therefore anything that appears to be a contradiction to our human eyes is merely a perfection which our brains are too puny to perceive. You've heard that argument?
Yeah, well, I used to believe that argument.
Oh, you used to make that argument.
Yeah, when I was when I just started out in studying the Bible, that was pretty much my view, is that the Bible had no mistakes in it, there were no errors, and if anything looked like an error, it was simply because I couldn't understand it well enough. And so part of what I talk about in the book is how I've moved away from that point of view to understanding the Bible as a very human book that, in fact, does have mistakes and errors in it, and what it is about the evidence that drove me to that new conclusion. You know, I just got to a point where the evidence was too strong for me, and so I had to change my view. But certainly there are a lot of people who think that the Bible can't have any mistakes in it, and if it can't have any mistakes, then obviously it doesn't have any mistakes.
Right, and that anything else we talk about is just nonsense, or that they're just putting their fingers in the air going, la, 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 la.
Yeah, there's a lot of la, la, la going on, I'm afraid.
Well, and so, and let's make the point again. You know, Bart has his MDiv from Princeton Theological Seminary, got his PhD there as well, but you were a graduate of Wheaton College. You studied at Moody Bible Institute. The first two are, you know, these are not liberal institutions of learning, right?
No, I would say Moody is a bastion of fundamentalism, and I went there and graduated from there, and was I liked it very much when I was there. And Wheaton
excellent
is the
school.
Alma mater of Billy Graham. It's also a very conservative evangelical school. So I
believe it's also the alma mater of John Belushi. Am I wrong on that?
I don't know if that's true. Is that true?
I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong. I'm pretty sure.
They didn't broadcast that when I was
they were,
at Wheaton.
I could check that. Maybe not. Maybe he's just from Wheaton. I can't.
Yeah.
But in your case, though, you know, you fell away from positions that you used to have, and now you have these, which some people consider to be very controversial positions. What do you think is the most controversial thing that you argue, either in Jesus Interrupted or Misquoting Jesus or any of your other many books?
I think, in some ways, the most controversial thing is the main point, which is that the Bible doesn't contain a single message about any important issue. The Bible has lots of different messages, sometimes contradictory messages about central themes about who God is, who Christ is, what salvation is. And the overarching point I have is that early Christianity, going back as far as the New Testament period, was extremely diverse, so that when people today talk about what a Christian view is or what the Bible's view is, I think that's completely wrong, because there's not a view of Christianity or a understanding in the Bible. There are lots of different views and lots of different understandings.
There's a pluralism that still exists in the Bible, that we can still see in the Bible, where we can understand better that there are competing views that are still there. We can still see the remnants of these ancient arguments.
That's right, and we just see the tip of the iceberg, and that's why it's a problem, I think, holding on to a very strong fundamentalist faith where you insist that you're right and everybody else is wrong. I mean, that claim is based on the idea that that truth is unitary, that there's only one form of the truth, and you know what it is. Well, the reality is, as far back as you can trace what Christians were saying, they were saying very different things, not just one thing.
By the way, I checked on it, and John Belushi went to Wheaton High School, but he didn't go to Wheaton College.
that makes a lot of sense.
That makes more sense, doesn't it?
Yes.
Help us. I mean, whether it's the Bible or whether it's the Quran or whether it's other sacred texts, how do we understand something as sacred if it is not divine in its origin?
Well, that's a great question, and that was a question that I struggled with for a very long time, because when I thought that the Bible had no mistakes in it and was the Word of God, written by God Himself, then of course it was sacred, and there was no logical problem with that. But once somebody starts seeing the Bible as a very human book, then the question is, well, if it's human, in what sense is it divine? And I think different theologians have different answers to that question, but most really sophisticated theologians have no problem with it at all. Sophisticated theologians would have no problem with anything that I say in my book, because they realize that the Bible is not some kind of inerrant revelation. But it's still possible, I'm not a believer myself anymore, but it's still completely possible to think of the Bible as a human book, but as nonetheless as a book through which God speaks. And so I think that's a more educated and enlightened view than the view that, God actually wrote the words.
What was it like for you? I'm asking you a personal question. Because after all these years of having been an evangelical teen and then as a young adult still working with the assumption that you were, after you got your Master's of Divinity, if you were going to be ordained, you were going to be in regular service of the church, even though you were getting your PhD, you were heading down that road still. And then at some point, as you say, you kind of fell away from belief as you, the more academic your approach came to the material, perhaps, and the more things you learned, the harder things were for you to reconcile. What was that like for you on the very first Sunday that you decided, I am no longer a believer?
Right. Well, it was a very long transition for me, and because for years, after I gave up being an evangelical Christian, I was a fairly liberal Christian. I was actually even the pastor of a Baptist church for a year when I in Princeton, New Jersey, and would preach every weekend and do all the things that pastors do. But gradually over time, my biblical scholarship made me start doubting more and more the Bible. And then other things started making me doubt my faith altogether. And there was a moment where I remember this pretty clearly. I was going near the end of my life as a Christian. I was going to an Episcopal church, and I realized that in the Episcopal church they say the Nicene Creed as part of the worship service. And there sure. came a point where in the Nicene Creed I realized I couldn't say any of the Nicene Creed except that he suffered under Pontius Pilate, was dead and buried. That was it. The rest of the creed I couldn't say. And once I realized that, I realized, well, I don't really belong here anymore. And And it was kind of sad in a way because, you know, I enjoyed being in the church. I enjoyed fellowship with other people, and I enjoyed being in a situation where you could actually ask big questions and think deep thoughts, and that was part of what it was all about. But I realized I didn't fit there anymore, and so then I felt like I really had to stop going.
Would you say then, would you posit that the Episcopal Church is the end of the line for Christianity?
You know, for me, it was the beginning of the line. That's where I started out in the Episcopal Church. And I think that the thing about the Episcopal Church is that it has such a wonderful liturgy, and it's focused much more on worship than on doctrine. And so Episcopalians, a lot of Episcopalians are not all that bothered about, you know, the specifics of doctrines, and they're certainly not bothered about the Bible having to be some kind of infallible guide. They focus on the liturgy and on the worship of God. And so I think for a lot of Christians, for a lot of very educated Christians, it's a terrific kind of community to be in.
But I think what you're hitting on, I have to say, the Nicene Creed and other creeds, I've always argued that the problem with creeds is that we attempt to make concrete that which should remain mystical.
Yes. Well, it's a good argument. And there are historical reasons for the creeds being developed.
Right.
You know, the Nicene Creed and these other creeds were largely developed in the 4th century and later when Christians were trying to figure out what it is they stood for. And there are so many points of view represented that they felt that they had to nail it down. And so these creeds represent 4th century attempts to nail it down. But when people say the creeds today, they don't realize that what it is exactly they're saying because they don't understand what it is these creeds are actually opposing.
Well, the actually Pew Research, I mean the people with that do the, you know, ongoing research about people of faith, something like 70% of people who regularly recite the Nicene Creed, I'm kind of pulling that number out of we'll call it thin air, that they don't believe it. And they're not bothered by the idea that they don't believe every line in it, that's not the purpose that it serves is no longer the purpose that it served in the 4th century.
I think that's right. I think it's almost a way of saying I belong to this community and this is what this community's tradition is. You know, there are of course many, many millions of Christians who don't believe literally in a virgin birth, for example, which is part of the creed. And so in a lot of Christian churches, there's not an insistence that you have to believe literally everything here, but it is part of your tradition, and so you recite the creed.
It's to me, and I don't have I recite the Nicene Creed all the time. It's a little bit more like the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right. Yeah, it is kind of like that.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean I'm not informed by it, but it doesn't define my faith. It informs my faith, but it doesn't define it. But all right, so that's me. So let's get into what are the hidden contradictions in the Bible and why we don't know about them. We've talked a little bit about the why. We've talked a little bit about Dr. Ehrman's experience in going from one side of the faith spectrum to no longer being on the faith spectrum. But coming up in just a few minutes, we'll get to the actual hidden contradictions in the Bible and what is said versus, well, what's said in one section versus what's said in another. And where do these contradictions come from? And why? How are they, in some cases, how are they hidden? We'll get to that coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. More Bart Ehrman coming up here in just a few minutes on the contradictions in the Bible. Don't be afraid. They're very interesting. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised. We're human. Roswell and the Reich tomorrow night. Joseph Farrell does so much interesting research. I gotta go into this with an open mind. He says there's a Nazi connection. If you read the original stories of Roswell, just stick with those. They'll make his case about secret technology from World War II coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. But also got the blog up at coasttocoastam.com. And thank you, everybody, who's linked me up as a Facebook friend. I won't be able to get to everybody that has asked. I hope to get to most of them. But I can't take any more anyway because I won't get to the ones I have. I made my 5,000. So thank you. And I look forward to staying in touch with you there online and back again on Coast to Coast next. This is Ian Punnett. Jesus interrupted, revealing the hidden contradictions in the Bible and why we don't know about them. You know, we are in that Lenten season for many of us, and I guess that makes it sort of a touchy subject for some. But the you can't talk about either this season of Lent or the New Testament for Christians without getting into the idea of just who Judas was. And what the varying testimonies about Judas from the Bible tell us. So, first of all, let me start. There's that book that came out last year called Judas, A Biography by Susan Gubar. Did you read that by any chance?
No, I didn't read it, no.
It's interesting. But she was making the case, you know, both in art and in history, the role of Judas has changed over time. Often he gets played off as sort of an evil character, and then sometimes he's played up as just sort of a misunderstood character, kind of like how he was in Jesus Christ Superstar. What's the witness on who Judas was, and what are some of the contradictions around that story?
Yeah, so just about it depends which gospel you read. You get very different pictures. In the earliest gospel, Mark, Judas betrays Jesus, but we don't learn anything about Judas before this happened, and there's no reason stated for him wanting to betray Jesus. As you move on into some of the later gospels, like the Gospel of Matthew, Judas wants the money. So he betrays Jesus for the 30 pieces of silver, and it's because he's greedy and he just wants the cash. In later Gospels, it's because the devil goes into him. The devil makes him do it in the Gospel of Luke. And in John's Gospel, Judas himself is said to be a devil. And so it's a little bit hard to know what's going on with the real Judas, because our testimony about why he did what he did differs.
Well, even in the way he died.
Well, the way he died is a flat-out contradiction in the New Testament. There, in three of the Gospels, there's no reference to Judas dying. But he does die in the Gospel of Matthew, where we're told that he went out and he hanged himself. And that's what most people then think because of what's said in Matthew. But when you read the book of Acts in the New Testament, the fifth book of the New Testament, there's another account of Judas dying in which it doesn't say that he hanged himself. It says that he fell headlong and he burst forth in the midst and he bled all over this field called the Field of Blood. And so that's not a hanging, and it's not quite clear exactly what it is, but he dies some other way. And then there are later traditions still that are a little bit more grotesque and maybe even more interesting that talk about Judas bloating up and becoming so enormously fat that he finally just kind of split and died that way.
Yeah, and that it was sort of an instantaneous bloating, or bloating over, say, the next 20 years as he just let himself go.
It wasn't bloating like a balloon suddenly. It was over a period of time, but we're not told how much time. But this is a reference by a church father named Papias, who says that he got so large that he couldn't pass down the street. Not even his head could fit through a place where a wagon could go. He got so enormous.
I love that. Like, he's like a Macy's float.
Yeah,
he's like a balloon float.
Yeah, who gets too inflated and ends up blowing up. Yeah.
Like Veruca Salt, wasn't it? Which was one in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory who
blew up? Right, exactly.
Was that, maybe that was Veronica. I can't remember. Anyway.
Right.
So all right, but what do those two different stories tell us? What is the reader of Matthew supposed to get by the hanging versus him exploding, you know, him bloating up and exploding and having, you know, SpaghettiOs go everywhere? It seems like one is just a guy who's humiliated ashamed of what he has done. He's so contrite, he can't even look at his own reflection, so he hangs himself. And then the other is some sort of divine retribution.
That's exactly right. The different stories are trying to tell, make different points. And that's the case with almost all of the contradictions in the early Christian traditions, is that the reason there are contradictions is because people are trying to emphasize different things. And so in Matthew's account, it's trying to emphasize that he realized that he had made a horrible mistake, and so even though he did it for the money, he ended up giving the money back, and then out of contrition, hanging himself. And in the story in Papias, it's to show that God has the last word, and he punishes sinners, and so this is how he punishes Judas.
I'm reminded, I have a mouse in my house. In fact, even just last week when I was doing Coast to Coast, a mouse came running into the studio where I am, and then saw me and then ran out again. And I was talking about this on the radio the other day, and somebody said, you know, there's kind of a, well, I mean, if there's such a thing as a humane way of getting rid of mice, they said, put out mashed potato flakes, instant mashed potato flakes and water. And the mice will come and they'll eat the mashed potato flakes. They will gorge themselves on the mashed potato flakes. They'll get thirsty. They'll drink the water and then they'll explode. And I it's sort of like Judas in that way, you know, that but as tradition goes, I mean, they both can't be right. Obviously, both versions can't be true. And as so often happens, people try to reconcile anything that's disparate. Some people come along and try to reconcile. And I've heard somebody make the argument that he hanged himself, but he didn't quite get it done right. Came down and stumbled nearly dead into the field of blood. And it was because he was hanging and his intestines and his other organs had been, you know, dislodged and were hanging low into his system, into his belly, that he split open. And that's why both versions are true.
Yeah, when I was an evangelical Christian, we were all experts at reconciling all of these discrepancies, and that's certainly one way to do it. The difficulty is actually in other details in the story. One question is, who bought the field of blood, and why is it called a field of blood? In Matthew's version, the priest take the money that Judas returns, and they can't put it back in the treasury because they call it blood money. In other words, that Judas betrayed innocent blood with it, and so they buy this field, and so it's called a field of blood because it's purchased with blood money. In the book of Acts, it's Judas who purchases the field himself with the money that he got from the priest. And the reason it's called a field of blood is not because it's because he died on it and spilled his blood on it. It's called the field of blood because he bleeds all over it. He bursts open and bleeds. And so, you know, those kinds of detailed contradictions, I think, are harder to reconcile than the broader concepts of how it is he died. Although I have to say that this reconciliation of them by saying that, you know, that he both hanged himself and split open in the midst it's a bit far-fetched.
Well, we know that whoever named it the Field of Blood had no intention of ever subdividing it as housing.
Probably right. My guess is that there was actually a field there in Jerusalem that was used by the local potters that had red clay, and they called it the Field of Blood because it had this red clay in it. And then somehow or other, Judas's death was connected with that field, and the different authors had different ways of explaining the relationship between his death and the name of the field.
Well, then again, then I take back what I said. I might buy a home in a development called Field of Blood if it was just about potter's clay.
But
if it were,
yes, right.
If it was anything, I would, the homes of Bloody Field or something like that, that's not where I would want to buy a three-bedroom place. The book is Jesus Interrupted. Bart Ehrman is the author, professor at Duke University.
North Carolina.
North Carolina. Your wife is the professor at Duke.
My wife teaches at Duke, and so it's a constant conflict.
Yes, I'm sorry. I forgot. Sorry, I didn't mean to have you switch sides.
Right.
And And so, you know, this is that idea of reconciling the contradictions. This is something which gets a lot of people very excited, and they hope to. But this is something that's been going on for centuries, too. I mean, this is nothing new. It speaks to a time when, as you write in some of your other books, when there were these sort of competing Christianities. And the one that we have by and large today, and I think there are even competing Christianities within the orthodoxy of modern Christianity, but the ones back then, some of them were wildly different, and yet they were still going under the brand name of Christianity. Can you talk about some of the ones that were attempting to use the same name? We're Christians, but we believe X.
Yeah, I think you're right that it's still going on today. I mean, when I was growing up as an evangelical Christian, we didn't think the Catholics were really Christian, let alone Eastern Orthodox, and that kind of thing was going on in the early church, but even in a more extreme way. So we now know on the basis of archaeological discoveries and such that there were Christians who called themselves Christians, who thought that they were representatives of the true faith, who didn't believe that there was just one God, who believed, for example, that there were two gods, or there were Christian groups who said that there were 36 gods. We know of a Christian group that maintained there were 365 gods.
Why these numbers? Who were the gods?
The 365, is so you could have a prize for God of the day.
Right.
Was
that kind of the same idea that there are different saints' days?
I was actually just joking about that, but yeah.
Well, no, I got it, but I mean, it seems pretty close to saints' days.
Yeah, right? No, I know it is, all of these numbers are symbolic, and so, well, not all of them. The two gods, the point of view that almost won out in early Christianity that had a lot of followers is a view, in fact, that some people resonate with today, which is that the God of the Old Testament doesn't seem like the God of the New Testament. And so there were early Christians who said that, in fact, there are different gods, that the God of Jesus is not the same as the God who called Israel to be his people and gave them the law, that the God of Jesus came to save people from this wrathful God of the Old Testament. But they thought that it was literally that there were two different gods. That's a point of view that that a lot of people resonated with, especially among the non-Jews in the Christian community. But it's a view that ended up losing, and that's why, getting back to the Nicene Creed, that's why the creed begins by saying, we believe in one God. You know, it might seem like an odd thing to say today, since anybody who believes in God basically believes in one God, but the creed emphasizes that it's one God you believe in, to differentiate people saying the creed from the people who thought there were two gods, or 12, or 36, or whatever.
I have a friend who's a professor at the University of St. Thomas here in the Twin Cities, and his name is Dr. David Penchansky, and he wrote a book called Twilight of the Gods, and his argument is, and I always have to be very careful because if I don't get it right, I hear about it. So his argument is that in the Old Testament text, or for Christians, in the original Hebrew text, there actually are many gods, and that it isn't, that it is not, that there's a in the Old Testament itself, you see right there in the text, if we're willing to look at it, evidence of polytheistic Hebrews and monotheistic Hebrews. Yeah. And that they were talking about the same thing, but in kind of two different ways. And some say one God, and other refer to God as the God of gods.
Yes. It's interesting that the Hebrew word for God actually is a plural word. Elohim, right.
Elohim.
Is plural. But, people don't realize this, but even within the Ten Commandments, there's an indication that there are multiple gods, because the first commandment is, you shall have no other gods before me. So that commandment is not, you should believe that there is only one God. The commandment presupposes that there are numerous gods, but that the Israelites are supposed to worship only this one God. But that implies a plurality of gods, which is quite different from what most people today believe.
Well, and I think a lot of folks would argue that the way that wisdom is spoken of in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Christian Old Testament, that wisdom is spoken of as a divine being, as almost having a body and being sentient in a way that wisdom is said, you know, to have been when I believe I'm quoting this right, when I was a child, God was bouncing me on God's knee, basically. That wisdom has always been associated, but wisdom had a kind of almost a life arc.
Yeah. The key passage is Proverbs chapter 8, where wisdom, capital W, wisdom, seems to be some kind of divine being that God creates at the very beginning, wisdom then creates the world. This was an important passage for the Christians who wanted to end up saying that Christ was the Word of God, and they associated the Word of God with the wisdom of God, so that they said then Christ is the one being talked about in Proverbs 8. But in any event, however you interpret Proverbs 8, it's pretty clear that this is talking about some kind of divine being who was residing with God before the world was created.
There is, of course, then two creation stories. Maybe then we can make an argument for a third creation story if we think about wisdom being the one that creates the world. But you do have the other two creation stories that are right there in the same book in Genesis, and they have a different chronology. They seem to have a different theology of how the world is created.
That's right. I talk about this briefly in Jesus Interrupted, even though the book is mainly about the New Testament, but there's certainly this kind of problem that you get in the Christian Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, and you get it right off the bat, so that you have the famous creation story of Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth story. But then in chapter 2 you have the Adam and Eve story, which is another creation story, that if you actually compare what Genesis 2 says with what Genesis 1 says about how the world got created, there are numerous inconsistencies and discrepancies.
John Dominic Crossan, former priest, I think he's from former priest.
Yeah.
If not, he soon will be, if he isn't learned. And he writes, he wrote a very interesting book about Judas, to go back to the New Testament story that we were talking about, in which he says he even questions whether or not there really was a Judas.
Yeah. There have been a lot of people who've wondered this over the years, because the word Judas, of course, is closely related to the word Jew. And some people have thought that that what happened was that in early Christianity, the Christians blamed the Jews for Jesus being turned over to the Roman authorities, and that somebody made up a story in which this prototypical Jew, Judas, is responsible for it, but that there was no actual historical figure of Judas. I don't agree with that myself, but I can certainly see the logic of it and why people might think this, because what it does is it shows that from the very beginning, Christians and non-Christian Jews were in antagonistic relationships with one another.
And maybe you could argue still are today. The book Jesus Interrupted sort of informs both sides of the debate. As a former evangelical Christian turned agnostic, are you of the belief that the events, by and large, not asking you to hold, I'm not holding your feet to the fire in all details, but the events, by and large, of the New Testament are true?
You mean historically true?
Historically true.
Yeah,
that there was a Jesus.
You know, I get a lot of emails from people over the last year or two who want to argue that Jesus never existed, you know, that he's a myth that was made up. And I just don't believe that. I think Jesus actually existed, and that we can know a lot of things about him. I think the historical evidence is simply too compelling. And so in a future book, I'm going to write about this, because it's become so popular just to discount all of this information.
Okay, we'll pick it up there. Bart Ehrman, Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions of the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. You will, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.